Well, good morning. All right, most of you are awake. It's good to see you guys. I'm Brent, and we're really glad you're here today. And I got to tell you, I'm really excited. A couple weeks ago, I was in my office, and I'm looking at news on the internet. Anybody else do that sometime during the day? Of course not. You all work diligently for the 8 hours you're there. No, but I was looking at different things, and I love, for some reason, to look at different news sites. And something I came across really excited me. I couldn't wait until this happened. And it was a movie trailer that was released for a movie that's coming out in November. Stars one of my favorite actors, and it has something to do with something I just absolutely loved as a kid. Does anybody know what I'm talking about yet? Okay. Oh, there's one hand. I see that hand. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood is going to be a new movie that's coming out in November. It's going to feature Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers. And while this movie, as I've looked it up, is not necessarily about his life, it is about the impact that he had. And when you think about Mr. Rogers, he was this non-assuming individual, and he wasn't overbearing. He was just this nice, soft-spoken guy. And I think about him, and I think how a simple phrase said in just a nice, soft, soothing tone, "Hello, neighbor," how that made everyone want to live next door to Mr. Rogers. I mean, am I the only one that wanted to live there? I mean, I loved Mr. Rogers. And so just to share my excitement with you, I thought I'm going to show you just a snippet of the movie trailer this morning. Now, granted, he's no Fred Rogers, right? But he doesn't do bad. I must admit, though, when I watch this, there's moments where I'm like, is that a Forrest Gump impersonation right there? But, I mean, that's just my mind playing tricks on me. No, I'm very excited for this movie. I think it's going to be great. But do you know what made Mr. Rogers so appealing for over 3 decades? He was just real. He was authentic. He was willing to treat kids like real people. He didn't talk down to them. He treated them like real people. He wasn't dismissive. He even was willing to address difficult subjects. Like, he would talk about it when your pet dies, and he would talk about how you process that. He even had shows dealing with incredible tragedy, like the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy, or other national tragedies, like when the Space Shuttle Challenger blew up. He wasn't afraid of addressing these things, and he would talk to kids and help them not suppress those feelings and act like don't have them. He would help them deal with them and learn how to process them. And he wouldn't give them just these pat answers, but he would help them deal with these honestly. I didn't realize it until I was researching it this week, just how profound of an impact Mr. Rogers had, because in 1969, when segregation was still a part of this country, which is crazy to think about because that wasn't that long ago, Mr. Rogers hired a black actor to play a recurring character on his show. Does anybody remember his name? I didn't. I had to look it up. Officer Clemens is what I found. Anybody? That was new to me. But he hired this guy. And think about this for just a moment. So in 1969, segregation is still part of our culture, sadly. And not only was it part, it lived out in very real ways, like in public swimming pools where they would not allow black people and white people to be together. And I saw a very disturbing video where there was a news image where some black people were swimming and somebody ran by with acid and threw it in the pool and tried to throw it on people because they were in the pool. That was the climate, a very sad climate. And yet Mr. Rogers not only hired this guy, but there was an episode where he invited Officer Clemens to put his feet in a kid's swimming pool together, and where they swam right there. That is groundbreaking. That is a man willing to step into something that the culture was unwilling to really address. You see, the thing about Mr. Rogers is it didn't matter who you were, or where you'd come from, or what you looked like, or really even what you believed, that everyone was welcome in Mr. Rogers' neighborhood. Anybody else feeling really nostalgic right now? I know. I know. You're like, hurry up, Brent. I got to go home and YouTube Mr. Rogers so I can watch some of these episodes again. I know. I'm the same way. But this is, to me, this is a powerful image when you think about this couldn't happen at a public swimming pool. Take yourself over to the Clive Aquatic Center or Valley View Aquatic Center, and this wouldn't have happened in 1969. And what a statement. when he said, "Hello, neighbor," he really meant it. He meant it to everyone, regardless of your background, your history, your complexion, your beliefs, anything. You know, right now we're in this series that we call Remix, and we like to do these every now and then because as we've done series throughout the years, there's some series we really enjoy, and we want to come back to them again, and sometimes there's a message that we thought about later, but we didn't want to move the schedule, so we thought, oh, we can do that now. Sometimes we need to correct some things or reemphasize some things. And so today, what we want to do in the Remix series, we want to go back to one that we did in the fall. And it was one that I really enjoyed because I thought it was one of our great series, but it was one called Fences. You guys remember Fences? Where it was all about maintaining healthy relationships. And so that's what I want us to look at today. In this series, we dealt with topics, and we used that whole fence analogy, and we talked about how sometimes we need to mend fences through reconciliation or through peacemaking. We talked about how sometimes we need to tear down fences through hospitality or those kind of things, and then we also talked about how sometimes there's reasons for us to build fences. We need to set healthy boundaries, that being responsible to someone and for someone is a different thing, and so sometimes we need those boundaries in place. And so if you missed that series, let me tell you, go back and find it. It's on our website. It's on iTunes. It's on Spotify. You can pick it up any place. And go take a listen because it was a really good series. But today what I want to look at is kind of a re-look at some of the things we talked about but adding to it a little bit. To look at what we learned from Mr. Rogers, realizing that when he developed this idea of being a neighbor, it wasn't something that he came up with on his own. It wasn't something that even a creative marketing team sat around and said, hey, you know what? We need to come up with a theme, an idea that'll really hit children and bring children and families in. What could we do? I know. Let's talk about a neighbor. No, that's not how this came about. In fact, if you know Mr. Rogers, you know that he was actually a Presbyterian minister. And I am confident that what led him to create the show he did wasn't his own thoughts or ideas, but actually something he read in the Bible. Something that is very significant, and it's what he wanted to teach all of us. And it's the idea he learned from Jesus, and that's just simply this: how to be a neighbor. How do we be a neighbor? In three of the four Gospels in the New Testament, there's a story that's recorded. And I'll tell you that anytime a story is in three Gospels, I think we need to pay attention. There's some significance there. And we find this story of Jesus where he's interacting with the crowd, and he's asked a question about the commandments. Now, we typically don't think much about commandments except maybe when we're speeding down the road and hoping a cop doesn't show up to give us a ticket. But, I mean, in my normal life, I'm not sitting down thinking about the Ten Commandments that often. You know, don't lie, don't, you know, take God's name in vain, remember the Sabbath, honor your father and mother, all those. Those aren't typically rotating through my brain. But in the time of Jesus, these were really significant. These were very, very important, and the Jewish people were deeply concerned about these commandments. They were concerned about them because they believed that it was by living by these commandments that you would be right, you could be right with God. So when God spoke to Moses and gave him the Ten Commandments on the mountain, it was the start of this moral and legal code that would govern the lives of the Jewish people. And what we know as the Ten Commandments, if you read in the book of Numbers and the Leviticus and Deuteronomy and those places, you'll understand that that's just kind of the beginning. Because it wasn't just 10, that there were actually over 613 laws or commandments that were given to the people to follow. And then, just like any good legislative body would do, they wouldn't stop with just what was given there. They liked to expound on them and write regulations and guidelines on how to follow these things. And so they created this entire system around these laws. And so it was very important because they're thinking, if I want to be right with God, then I've got to follow all these things. And as you can imagine, then there were some experts and people that rose up in the ranks, and they said, well, I will glean for all of you how you should live. I will point out for you when you're wrong and tell you how to follow these rules properly. And so that's what's going on here in the time. And what's crazy is when you begin to look at it is that they became such legalists about the law that they forgot the spirit of the law and wanted to follow only the letter of the law, even to the point where they would often look for loopholes to try to get out of it. To say, well, I technically met the law, even though they may not have done what the law was asking them to do. But one day, one of these teachers, religious leaders, one of these people that knew the law really well, had a pressing question for Jesus, and that's where the interaction I want us to look at today. We're going to look at Mark's version of this in Mark chapter 12, and let me read this to you. It'll be on the screen as well. It says, one of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating. Now, you go back for the context. They're talking about resurrection and are you married in heaven and all this fun stuff. If you're curious, you can go back to verse 18 and read all about that. So there's this debate going on, and they notice, as noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, this guy, this teacher of the law, asked him, of all the commandments, which is the most important? Now, you think about this, and you think, that's a tricky question, right? There are 613 commandments, laws, that they're supposed to be practicing, and this guy wants to kind of put his finger on Jesus to say, which one is most important? In other variations of this story in Matthew and Luke, you get the impression that they're almost trying to trick Jesus, to try to trap him, because at this point they don't care for him, and they want to trip him up. They want to get him to say something that they can arrest him for and hold against him. So he says, which of the commandments is the most important? And Jesus answered, and he says, the most important one is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. The second is this, love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. A trick question in some regards, but Jesus gives a very specific answer. Now, when you read this in Luke's gospel, Luke chapter 10, you'll find a very familiar story tacked onto this, where Jesus actually goes in to give an explanation of the parable a little bit, where he tells them the story of the Good Samaritan. And I encourage you to read that if you want to. But the Good Samaritan's basically a story that Jesus told about a guy traveling who gets robbed and beaten almost to death. There are three people that pass by, two religious people who ignore him and ignore the need. And then there's a Samaritan who walks by. And the Samaritan was an enemy of the Jewish guy that had been beaten. But the enemy is actually the one that helps, binds his wounds, puts him on his donkey, carries him to an inn, and makes sure that he is taken care of. It's a very powerful story. But you know, you have to admit that the guy who's asking this question, it's a good question. It's a good question, and I think it's one that at some point maybe all of us ask. How can I be right with God? How can I be accepted by God? I want to live my life right. I want to do the right things. And if I believe there are rules to getting there, then I want to know which ones can I not really have to pay attention to and which ones do I not even want to play with and I want to make sure I follow completely. But what's interesting in this moment isn't really to me the question that's asked, but it's Jesus' answer. Because it's interesting to me not necessarily just what he does say, and we're going to get to that, but it's interesting to me what he doesn't say. Because what he doesn't say is he doesn't say the important commandments are, you know, go to church at least 20 times a year, give at least 10% of your money away. He doesn't say, you know, make sure you pray every day, make sure you read your Bible 2 hours a week. But what he does say is very telling. Because he takes everything that's supposed to be governing our lives and he really brings it down to the two most important. And he begins by talking about our relationship with God. And he begins by telling the man and us, love God. Love God. That's number one. And he says to him, he's actually quoting Deuteronomy right here, Deuteronomy 6, something that every Jewish person would have grown up repeating and knowing, called the Shema. But he says, you're supposed to love God not just occasionally, not just when it's convenient, not when you think about it, but with every fiber of your being, your heart, your soul, your mind, and your strength. And to me, this is the answer that we might expect. But Jesus doesn't end there and say, just love God and you'll be fine. He continues to say that there's an equally important aspect that we must pay attention to as well. That in life, in this life, it's not just enough for us to be concerned about God and our relationship with Him. That there's something that can affect our relationship with God even beyond just our interaction with God. Now, I want to just take a little moment and step aside and interject something here. If we're not careful, we might want to reduce what Jesus says in this moment down to just nothing more than a moralistic message. Do the right thing and you will be right with God. But that is not what Jesus is saying at all. Because when you look at the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus, you understand that what makes us right is not right behavior, but the right heart. And that is not something that you or I would ever be able to create or recreate or restore on our own. It's something that Jesus has to do for us. His work on the cross is what makes it possible for our brokenness to be restored, our bondage to be broken, and our sin to be forgiven. And it's when we surrender to God that we experience the power of God that changes us on the inside. And when we experience the power and the presence and the love of God, we don't have to manufacture something. We don't have to make something happen. We don't have to remind ourselves that, oh yeah, I'm supposed to love God. Because we experience something so incredible, so life-changing, so unearthly, some incredibleness that we are inwardly compelled. We're not forced. It's just a drive within us that says, I want to love God. And it's that response that Jesus is talking about. You know, the best way I know to describe it is, you know, a few times in our marriage, Carrie has done some really crazy things, and I'll have something on my mind, like there's a gift that I, like something I want to buy myself. And I'll think about it, and I'll research it, and I'll look long and hard, and I'll finally get one picked out that I want, and then I'll convince myself not to get it. It's too much money. And so, you know, I go back and forth. And then on a birthday or a Christmas or something, I'll get there, and Carrie will be like, here, I got you something. And I'm like, oh, great. We said we weren't going to get each other anything, and here you go. And I'll open it, and I'll find it's the exact thing that I'd been looking at. Now, she'd been sneaky. She'd found stuff around the house to sell so she could make money on the side so I wouldn't see it run through the checking account or through the credit card or anything. And so she's working this on the side. And I get it, and let me just tell you what happens when I open it. I'm elated. I'm overjoyed. I'm just beside myself. Nobody has to look at me and say, now, Brent, you need to tell Carrie thank you. You need to hug her and express affection towards her because of what she's done. No, nobody has to tell me these things. You know why? Because when I opened it, the gift that she has given me, the thought behind the gift, and all the work that she has done to do to show her love for me is all that I've had to see, and my heart responds naturally. And that is what Jesus is talking about. When we encounter the love of Jesus, you don't need me up here telling you Sunday after Sunday, love God. Love God. You know what that does to you? If you don't love God, it just creates guilt, and that's not what we're after. What we need is to understand what Jesus has done. That's why we observe communion, to remember the incredible sacrifice of a God who loves us so much that he lived among us and died for us so that you could have life. And when we truly wrap our minds around that, I don't have to say love God. You say, stop me from loving God, because you can't, because my heart is overwhelmed and compelled to love God just because of his love for me. Now, when Jesus says to love God, that is not a surprising thing. We would all expect Jesus to say that. But what he follows it up with saying might surprise us a little, because the next part is the Mr. Rogers part, because he says, not only do we need to love God, he says, you also have to love your neighbor. You see, what Jesus is telling us is this incredible point, and I think sometimes we forget this. He is saying how we interact with the world around us, the love or the apathy that we express towards those near us, is equally as important as the love we show God. Now, let that thought just sit in your mind for just a second. Because I think if we border on the religious side of life, if all we want to do is check off the religious duty of following Jesus, this would be a problem for us. Because you would think, well, I pray, I sing those worship songs, I show up to church, I give some money, that ought to be enough. And Jesus in this moment says, but it's not. It's not. There's something else. You're not just going to be compelled to love God, there's going to be another inward drive that comes out in you when you experience the love of Jesus, and that is going to be demonstrated in the love that you have for the neighbor. And Jesus, the way he frames this conversation, he says something really significant. He says, you know what? In this world, there will be people that are good people, and they love their neighbors, they do good works, they are socially minded, they're helping feed the hungry and clothe the naked and all those kind of things. And you can do that and not have any spiritual mindedness at all. I think sometimes Christians like to say, oh, no, you can't be a good person at all if you don't know Jesus. No, there's a lot of good people that don't know Jesus and are good. They're trying to do good things in the world. And that's possible. But what Jesus is saying is that it is impossible to love God and not show love for your neighbor. It is impossible to say or to claim that you love God and not show love for the neighbor. You see, those two things hand in hand. You can't take one without the other. You can't claim, well, but I love God. But how are you treating the people around you? How do you treat the people that live next door to you? How do you treat your coworkers at the office? How do you treat the people around you? How do you treat the stranger and the foreigner and all those? All this comes into play. Jesus says it matters. Because the way we interact with those around us reveals more about your relationship with God than your attendance on Sunday morning. Did you catch that? How you interact with the people around you says more about your relationship with God than how many times you show up here and how loudly you sing and how big the check is that you drop in the offering plate. And if we are self-focused and unconcerned about those around us, it is a very good indication that we really aren't following the Jesus that we say we do. Now, why would I say that? Because if we say we follow Jesus, we will do what Jesus did. We will live like Jesus did. And when you read the New Testament, when you read the stories of how Jesus interacted with people, he demonstrated love for those around him, even and especially those who were the most hated and reviled in society. Those that society had tossed aside and said were of no value, Jesus said, oh, yes, you do. You are God's creation, created in the image of God, and you matter. And so if we think we get to show up here on Sunday and do our religious thing, and the next 6 days of the week, we do our own little thing in our own little hub, in our own little family, driving in and shutting the door behind us and not interacting with the people around us or the people we work with, we're wrong. Because Jesus says that when we don't show love for others, for the neighbor, in essence, it's saying we really don't love God. You see, Jesus, there's one word that's often used in the New Testament to describe how Jesus interacted with people, and the word is compassion. His compassion moved him to action, to engage with them, to lean into spending time with them, getting to know them, to help them and heal them and when he could. So we're called to love not just God, but love the neighbor. So who is my neighbor? That's a great question, right? Luke 10, that's the whole reason that Jesus goes into the parable of the Good Samaritan. Who is my neighbor? So how do, you know, let's answer that. You know, sometimes when preachers talk about this message and they use the Luke passage, they do it because they want to tell you, well, everybody's your neighbor. And yeah, we need to look at those that are different than us as our neighbor. It doesn't matter your skin color, your creed, your race, your ethnicity, your southern accent, whatever. It doesn't matter. None of that, you don't take any of that into account. Jesus told the story of the Good Samaritan, said even the enemy is your neighbor. But you know what I find sometimes is that sometimes we can make a definition so broad that it absolutely does us no good. Because when everybody is your neighbor, nobody's your neighbor. And it really kind of lets us off the hook to say, well, I really don't have to do anything unless I see somebody beaten on the side of the road bleeding to death, and I don't really have to do it. You see, I think that we have to redefine and think a little bit more literally about what Jesus is saying who our neighbor is. Because in Mark 12, when he says, love your neighbor, he means it very literally. He's meaning it those who are in close proximity to you. That's who your neighbor is. And the obvious answer is those who live next door, but it's also those you work next to, or maybe the coffee shop you frequent that you're around certain people, or the ball fields where your kids play sports. And think for just a moment, how many people are potentially your neighbors just from that definition? And how many of those get on your last nerve? So you thought I was going to say, how many of those do you love, right? No, how many of those do you look at and go, I mean, I get it. I have coworkers. No, I'm just kidding. It's been a great week. He's been on vacation. No, I'm just kidding. I've missed my friend. No. How many of those do you say you love? How many of those do you really say you love? And I ask you this question not because I want you to feel guilty, but I want to really kind of highlight a problem in our culture today. And I think it's especially a problem in the church. We can't be a neighbor in reality because the majority of Christians don't even know their neighbors. We don't know much about them. And let me just tell you, I'm the world's worst. There's neighbors around me. I'm still trying to figure out their names. And how sad is that? We don't know their names. We don't know their stories. We know so little about them. And we can't be good neighbors if we don't start somewhere. I was recently reading a really good book on this topic. It's called The Art of Neighboring. Anybody read that one? It's a great book. I highly encourage you, if you like to read, it's an awesome book. In fact, if you read it, you're going to think, I know where Brent got most of this message. Yeah, okay. You know, in it, they talk about when you don't know the people who live next door to you. What happens? You know what happens? You live in isolation, you live in fear, and you live in misunderstanding. You think about that. I mean, even in our own neighborhood, we have a neighbor next door to us, and she's got a cat, and the cat runs the neighborhood, and we hate this cat. The cat lives under my deck, and if you ever come to my house, you'll see the cat run off. I wish the woman would take care of her cat. Now, our immediate assessment of the situation is she's a terrible neighbor. She's a horrible person. I don't want to love her. Put your cat in the house. But what I don't know and what I need to know is maybe there's something deeper here. How do I know she's not a single mom who's struggling to make ends meet and can't really take care of the cat because it's overwhelming her? How do I know she's not medically sick or ill and got cancer and struggling through chemo because I don't know her? You see, when we live in isolation, when we live in these little bubbles that we do, we make these assumptions, we tell ourselves those stories, and we believe that, oh yeah, well, they have to be this way. And we assume the worst about people. Even Christians do that. Isn't that amazing? We just assume the worst about people. But what we are called to is we're told to lean into this, to love our neighbor, to get to know them. And I want to tell you that it won't be easy and it's going to be messy. You know why? Because you're messy. The Clarks are messy. Let me just tell you, Carrie's out of the country right now. She and Liz are down in Nicaragua exploring a potential gap year for Liz after she graduates. So I'm single parenting with the help of my oldest child back there, who is a tremendous help. But let me just tell you, it's messy in my house right now. Physically and literally, I mean, figuratively. I mean, it's terrible. I mean, somebody said, well, are you parenting okay? I'm like, well, I don't think I'm screaming at the kids any more than I would if Carrie was around, but I doubt that's true. But lives are messy. And I get it. We don't want to get our hands dirty. We want to live in our nice little tidy environment and just assume everything will be fine. But you know what? What if in our isolation, what if in our self-focus, we miss out on truly understanding the heart of Jesus? Because we're really not loving our neighbor as ourselves. Think about this. Jesus wants us to follow him, and our desire, if we're a Christian, if we're following Jesus, our desire is to live like him. Can we really ever live like him and know him and understand him if we've got this entire huge aspect of loving our neighbor that we're unwilling to lean into? It'd be like me being married to Carrie and her having this whole world outside of me, not I don't know about and I don't experience. Do I really know her, especially if it's something she's incredibly passionate about? No, I would know this, not this. And that's, I think, about loving our neighbor. We really can't understand Jesus. And can I tell you that this is really not complicated? It's really not. We make it harder than it is. But do you realize how simple it is? I mean, it can begin with just this. Learn somebody's name. The Art of Neighboring talks about this. Create a block map. Put your house. In fact, if you want one of these when we're done, we're going to have these to hand out. It's a piece of paper. It has your house in the middle and has squares all around it and it encourages you. Get to know these people's names. Write their names in the block. Put this up on your refrigerator so every time you walk by, you're going, oh, yeah, Jim and Connie live right there. And you know what? As I walk by and I see, oh, Jim and Connie, God, I pray for Jim and Connie. And I hope that you become real to them and give us more opportunity for a relationship with them. You know, get to know their name. Create a block map. Put yourself in a position to meet people. I read a story that talked about a couple. They had kids, and they put a swing in the backyard. And they said, you know what? They realized they were missing out on interacting with people. So they took the swing. They put it in the front yard. And then they put some chairs out front. And so the kids are playing out front, and people were walking by. I was great in the spring and summer and fall. Anybody else's neighborhood just crawling with people all the time? Yes. What would happen if you put lawn chairs in the front of your yard as people walk by and hung a swing for kids to play on? For this couple, you know what happened? Eventually, neighborhood kids showed up. And then their parents showed up. And they did exactly what we're talking about. They became a neighbor, and they started loving their neighbor. And then you can host a block party, have sports parties, invite people over. Do you guys remember in the winter, we encouraged you guys to have Super Bowl parties? Do you know why? So you could love your neighbor. There's a, what is it? I wrote it down. There's 25 days until the start of college football. Whoop, whoop. There you go. Amen. Holla. You know, September 14th, big game in Iowa. Iowa State versus Iowa. If you don't have tickets, wouldn't that be a great opportunity to open your home, to encourage people to come in, have a fun rivalry together, make fun of each other, trash talk each other? What's more fun than loving that way? The goal is to just get to know one another. The goal is to build those relationships. Put up that next slide, because I think this is a great descriptor. It means we move from, hey, you, at the end of the driveway, to, hey, John. To, hey, John, how you doing? To, hey, John, can you help me with this? To, hey, John, how's that going? Isn't that a great way to think about it? Now, let me caution you here. I'm running out of time, but I want to caution you here. Our job, I'm not encouraging you to do this so that you can convert people. I am not encouraging you to be a neighbor so that you can convert people. Do you know how many salvations you are responsible for? How many?
None.
That's exactly right. Zero. And do you know what happens when you begin to reach out to neighbors and you have this motive in the back of your mind that, oh, I want to win you to the Lord? You can tell I grew up in the South, right? What happens? How many of you have been invited to somebody's house for dinner? And then after dinner, they pull out a piece of paper or a big notepad to tell you about a great and exciting opportunity they have for you. Anybody been there? Let's draw some circles and tell you, you know, they never draw triangles because that's what it is, but they always draw those circles and they want, what do you think in that moment? Wasted my time. You don't care about me. You only want me, my money, so that I can sign up under you and make you more money. How is Christianity any different when we try this whole bait and switch with people? People are not a project, and we shouldn't view them that way. In fact, we are called just to love people. In fact, that book I was telling you about, it said this. It says, we don't love our neighbors to convert them. We love our neighbors because we are converted. I love that statement. You see the difference? We can't pull that whole bait and switch thing and hope that this happens. Now, why do we do this? I think there are two possibilities. One of them is this. You hear this message today and you feel really guilty about it. And you're like, good Lord, I don't want Brent to preach on this ever again. So fine, I'll do something. And it's the outward pressure and the guilt that comes on you. And can I just tell you, that's the wrong motivation. And that will come through and your heart won't be in it and you'll never be a neighbor. But the other side of this is not from the outward pressure, but it's the inward pressure. It's the inward drive. It's what we were talking about earlier, because God has done something for us, because we have experienced his love for us, because God himself took on human flesh and moved into our neighborhood. John chapter 1 in the Message version of the Bible, that's exactly what the author says, is they took on flesh and moved into our neighborhood. That's what we are called to do, and we are moved by that, not out of guilt, not out of some moral mandate, but because of God's love for us. It compels us to want to love other people. We don't see this as a requirement, but we see this as a natural response. And honestly, we just can't help ourselves. So let me just wrap this up. I just want to end with this. Number one is just simply this. You know, maybe you're listening to this today, and you think, I want to love others, but I want to do it for the right reasons. And you realize that even right now, you've never experienced the love of Jesus. That is an offer that Jesus has. And he doesn't say, do these things and I'll accept you. No, Jesus loves you right now just the way you are. He went to the cross for you, and he wants you to experience that love and that freedom that he's offering you. And just like we are called to love others, not because of what they've done or can do for us, Jesus doesn't offer you life because of what you bring to the table. He doesn't refuse you life because of the baggage you may be carrying. He offers you life because he loves you. And he went to the cross where he died for your sin, and he rose from the grave so that you could experience life. If you want to know that, as we sing this final song, I'm just going to encourage you. I'll be up here. Our prayer team will be up front. Come, and we want to talk to you more about how to experience what we're talking about. But maybe you're already following Jesus, and you find yourself living in that bubble. I just close with this. Are you a good neighbor? Let me just be honest. I love to, you know, bare my soul to you guys. This is hard for me. I'd rather go home at night. I'm an introvert. I'd rather go home at night and shut the garage. Do I see some heads nodding? Yes, I understand your pain. I want to shut the garage door. I like my back deck. I love to take my iPad out to the back deck and find a good book and put my feet up on the fire pit and be by myself. Not even with my family most times, but just there. I'm that much of an introvert. But I also know that I look around my neighborhood and there are great and lovely people. They are wonderful people. And I'm not looking to convert them, but I just think, does it really hurt for me to kind of lean into that a little bit and to sit out on my front deck instead of the back one? One of the things Carrie and I have started doing is, you guys know we live right over there. J.C. Park is in our neighborhood, and so after dinner, we'll take the kids and we'll just walk down to J.C. Park. It's covered up with people most of the time. Haven't really had any real significant conversations yet, but it's an opportunity. And I'm just trying to open myself up, because I know that that's what Jesus did for me. And I'm not trying to make you feel guilty and say you have to do what I do, but I'll just ask you, are you loving your neighbor? The people next door, the people you work with, all those people. I want us as a church to do something different. I want us, not just here in this location, but in your neighborhoods, I want your home to become that place in your neighborhood where people find a place to belong, a place to be cared for, a place to be accepted, a place to experience a love that nothing else in this world can match.